Okay, call the committee to order. And where are we standing? What are we standing? This is. Okay. LCC starting off, I guess. Mr. Hubinger.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about our budget proposals for the next biennium. The joint legislative offices are a small but important part of the legislature, at least we believe so. We have about 140 staff compared to about 200 in the Senate and 250 in the House. Our annual budget is about $13 million a year. The budget for the Senate is about $20 million, and the budget for the House is about $28 million. So our budgets comprise about 22% of the budget of the full legislature. You should have a handout in your packet, a multi-page handout that's titled the Joint Legislative Agencies and Legislative Commission Budget Proposals for 08 and 09. It's a 15-page document, and I'll be referring to that. The second page of that document is a summary of our budget proposals for the next biennium. We show each agency the LCC base for 08, which is the same as the governor's rec, and then our proposed funding levels for 08 and 09. Before each of the directors provides a highlight for the budget proposals for their offices, I'd like to point out three items in that summary page, and they show up near the end of that long list on the summary page. The first one is the one titled Health and Dental Insurance Increases. This rule reflects the cost to our offices to pay for the employer portion of the health and dental increases in premiums that we'll be facing in 08 and 09. We assume the low end of the projected increases that have been projected by the Department of Employee Relations at 10%. The next two rows relate to a compensation study. You may be aware that the House and the Senate and the LCC each independently contracted with NCSL to conduct a compensation study for its employees. This was done during the last interim. While each of these studies was done separately, a common theme that was recommended in each of the studies was the development of a merit pool that would fund salary increases for all legislative branch employees. The amount in this line reflects that recommendation.
Okay. Is it silly of me to ask why all three were done separately, and could there have been some economy of scale in doing them all together?
Madam Chair, there was collaboration to a certain extent on the three studies. They were done by NCSL, which knows this place well. So the collaboration and integration and efficiency happened on the other end, more so on this than on this end.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the next line also relates to that study. It's entitled Comp Study Range Adjustment Costs. There was a small cost to adjust the salaries of about a dozen employees to bring them up to the minimum of the new ranges that were being recommended. Of course, any salary increases that actually take place have to happen after the House and Senate make their decisions and after the LCC makes a decision based on that. So as the directors review their individual budgets, please keep in mind that the budgets that they have proposed do not include any compensation increases. If there aren't any questions on the general part, I'd like to turn it over to Michelle Timmons from the Office of the Revisor of Statutes.
Any questions? Okay. Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, for the tape, I'm Michelle Timmons, the Revisor of Statutes, and I'm pleased to present the Revisor's Office budget request to you today. I'm going to be speaking from a two-page handout. You should have two things in your packet, a two-page handout that says at the top, Office of the Revisor of Statutes Budget Request Summary. I'll be speaking from that. And then I have included a lengthier PowerPoint presentation that was given to the revisor's subcommittee. Contains some interesting charts and graphs. I'm not going to be speaking to that in the interest of time, but it just contains more information for you to look at as you have time. So turning to that two-page handout, you can see that the revisor's office budget request has two components this year. A one-time request of a little over $508,000 to complete the computer project. And we also have base budget or operating budget requests that are shown there at the top of the page. These requests support three main goals for the revisor's office in the next biennium. Goal number one is to complete the extend project, complete the computer development project that that we started back in 2002. The second main goal is, now that we have that computer development project nearly complete, we need to be able to maintain that new system. And third, we also need to be able to continue to perform our core work. So the requests that I'll be walking you through relate to one of those three goals. The first goal, complete extend. That's the $509,000 one-time request. Well, first of all, we have a happy problem in that people like extend. It's more user-friendly than our old system, and so we are constantly getting requests for additional legislative users to be added to the system. We have virtually everyone in the revisor's office on already, so these additional people would be from the House or the Senate. We also need to complete the development of the programs to produce the administrative rules and the court rules. And the good news there is that that development is going very well because we're able to borrow a lot of the programming that we've already done for the legislative applications that we've implemented. But we did hit one big snag, and that is in the conversion of the administrative rules. We are having a lot of trouble converting tables, tabular material. Well, in the statutes, there are about 200 tables, and it took us many months to get those 200 tables converted. Well, in the administrative rules, we have 7,200 tables. So, that's right. So what we're proposing is a pool of money as part of this one-time request. About $100,000 of it would be to hire some temporary staff, either extend some of the temps we have on board for the 07 session or hire some new ones in advance of the 08 session and do a big push during this interim to convert those tables and do manual fixing of that. So, and those are precursor steps that we need to take before we can get off that ancient mainframe that really we did buy it in 1971, and I'm not making that up. And we really need to get off of that, and that will not only save us money, but we need to complete that. So a new target date for that is June 30th of 08. I've also included on the summary sheet here, one of the questions I always get asked is, well, how much have we spent on this project? And you can see that we will spend, with this additional money that I'm requesting, we will spend about $6.5 million total on the project. And I think that is in the ballpark. Illinois spent about $7 million. They completed a project maybe 2 years ago. And Kansas, Florida, and Texas are each in various stages of spending about $10 million. So that's the one-time request. Moving on to the second page of the handout.
Okay. I'm not sure which page it belongs on, but I have two questions.
Sure.
And then the first question is, we used to get bills, and when there was a repealer in the bill, we used to have the repealer printed out, and I thought that was great. It started up a little while ago, and we don't seem to get that this year. Why aren't we getting that?
You should be getting that. We have the program to print the repealed language, and once we get the administrative rules portion completed, we'll be able to print repealed rule language as well. So I'm not sure.
You should look.
I can look into that.
Almost any bill that I've looked at, I have not.
Okay.
I have not seen it. Then the other thing is, what I understand, the Supreme Court did this, and I don't understand. Why do we have to still maintain legal paper? Why can't we go to 8.5 by 11, which apparently would be an enormous tree? I know We don't have any people here who are Representative Solberg and Representative Sertich telling me.
We're all Iron Rangers at heart, right?
You know, more trees used the better, but why haven't we gone to, what, is there any good time for us to go to 8.5 by 11? And I was surprised to hear that the Supreme Court did do it.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members, well, we had a user needs group that of House and Senate and LCC and revisors and library staff that convened to look at the needs for this whole computer project. One of the things we talked about was going to 8.5 by 11 inch paper. At that time, there was the consensus of opinion was that it wasn't time to make that switch. There was concern about file cabinets and a lot of other corresponding costs and concerns about making that change. So what we agreed in that group is that we would program extend so that it would be relatively easy to make the switch to the 8.5 by 11, should the group desire to do so. And I said that I would be bringing the issue back to that group. So we haven't taken a second look at that issue, but I know there's interest, and I believe that we will in the interim.
When does the group meet again? And who's on?
Next interim, I will convene a meeting of that group.
And who is on it?
Oh, my. It's about 30. It's about 30 different people representing every staff group at the legislature.
I'd like a list of that. Obviously not now.
Sure.
Representative LaForest.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Ms. Timmons, I'm glad to see that the computer upgrade is paying off. That is good news. I was just curious. We don't have anybody in state government anywhere who can help out with Java development or Oracle DBase work? Is it? I'm looking at the one-time cost related to the extend program. There's not a page number on this.
Okay.
$658,000 one-time cost. I'm sorry, I'm referring to that.
Okay. Yes.
I see you have some money in here looking for Java developers, mm-hmm. as well as people experienced with Oracle database.
Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, and members, We have been using a mix of consultants and in-house developers to develop the project, and a lot of the cost of the project has been for consultants. At the beginning of this project, actually, it was recommended that we hire more staff so that there would be fewer consultants because they cost more. On an hourly basis than do staff programmers. However, the timing was not good. It was at the beginning of the budget crisis, and when I recommended hiring more staff, people laughed at me. So we were able to do the project, but with consultants. Now we need to keep those consultants on board at a much reduced level than we had during the big programming push of the project, and ultimately I'm trying to phase out the consultants and get more in-house programmers. In fact, you'll see on page 2 of the handout one of the things I've requested is an in-house web programmer position.
And Madam Chair, and Ms. Timmons, certainly I have high regard for the work your office does. I trust that this is the way we have to do it. But I guess, Madam Chair, it's just a comment on my part. I'm having trouble still keeping up with all this computer business. For those of you on this committee who do not sit on the Commerce Committee, we just passed out of the committee a couple days ago a $40 increase in the cost of a residential real estate license for renewal. And we all represent realtors. $40. For the sole purpose of a computer upgrade at the Department of Commerce. I just throw it out there, Madam Chair. Perhaps you can educate me on it or someone else on the committee. We seem to have these trains all running on different tracks regarding computers and technology upgrade. But Ms. Timmons, thank you. I appreciate your response.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, I'll quickly go through the base budget requests then on the second page of the summary handout. To maintain, extend, we really have three components: hardware, maintenance, and staff. As Representative De La Forest mentioned, it is less costly to have staff to do the programming work. Right, we've seen an 830% increase in the web activity since 1998. Because our slim group of in-house programmers have been all deployed to the main Extend application, we have no web programmer now. And currently, we have a wonderful consultant programmer, but he's $110. He's a Renaissance man. He's great, but he's $110 an hour. And so for about half of what a half-time consultant costs, we could hire a full-time entry-level programmer with benefits. So that's one of our requests. Also, we want to have a proactive replacement program on our hardware. Now that we have the new hardware, we need to replace it. And it's cost-effective to do so because what you do is you get 2, 3, 4, or 5 years of maintenance with a new purchase. So it helps keep your maintenance line item down. Then we also, since Katrina and the power outage at the end of the 2005 special session, a disaster recovery is on all our minds. So what we want to do is keep the most recently decommissioned equipment, stockpile that. I don't know where I'm going to put it yet, but we want to stockpile it, drop the maintenance on it to save money, but have it available to be able to bring us back up and running in the event of a disaster. We have many more components to the new system, much more commercial software, ergo more maintenance. The good news here is if we can get off the mainframe, that'll save us about $70,000 a year in the maintenance line item. So that's to maintain, extend. Then finally, last but not certainly not least, we need to continue to perform our core work. We're setting new drafting records for a long session, this session, probably not a surprise to anybody. The bill file number we're up to now is 3,835. So we're about a week ahead of the last previous record in 2005 for a long session. In light of this, I really am recommending that over time we restore two of the drafting and editing positions. Those are our entry-level data entry and proofreading positions in our production unit. Right now and through the fiscal crisis, we've gotten by with having a large group of temporary staff do this work. But one of the problems with that is that towards the end of the session, when we have all this volume and very frequently these temporary staff find full-time jobs and leave us, and then at the most critical time, we're short. So I've requested one in each year on that. And then finally, one of the ways in which we save money during the fiscal crisis was to extend a very favorable lowball bid we had received from Thompson West Publishing on the law books. And that came in 1999. We extended that all through the through 2006 or 2005, did a new bid in 2006, and of course it came in higher, 25% higher for the statutes publication, which is the biggest cost driver in this item. And with that, that's what I presented in terms of a highlight of the change items.
Okay, Representative Wharton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Timmons, right?
Yes.
We talked about this briefly in the hallway, but I just want to bring it up in committee also and to other people's attention. When we were doing the, we were all coming in January and getting the new statute books. There were a lot of totally unused 2004 statute books that were getting thrown in the dumpster. And I asked you briefly about whether we could have a system where people opt in to get new statutes. For example, there's only a couple volumes that I really look at and use. And I know that there are some staff that use certain volumes, but not other volumes. And I don't think that we all need a complete set of the statutes. So I don't know if that's ever been tried in the past, where it's an opt-in to get the statutes for both members and staff, and whether that's worked.
Madam Chair, Representative Hartman and members, we have not tried an opt-in. We have been doing an opt-out system for about a decade, where we send letters to members and, well, everybody who gets the free sets. There are about 1,700 free sets of the statutes, because all the judges get them, the various libraries, law libraries across the state. Very few people have actually written back to say they don't want the books. And then the other issue that comes into play here is unit cost. That if you, as you reduce the press run on the books, the unit cost effectively goes up. So what happens is, if you're just producing a few fewer books, your unit cost will go up, and it doesn't necessarily get you to where you want to go. So it's, unfortunately, we have tried it. It hasn't, at least for an opt-out system, and it hasn't been terribly successful.
Thank Madam Chair. Ms. Timmons, I would have opted out if I knew that there was an opt-out. I don't remember ever seeing anything that asked me to opt out. So I wonder if it's just the word isn't getting out on opting out. And even though the per unit cost would go up, I mean, we all do a lot of printing on our campaigns, you know that your per unit price goes down the more you order, but still you can get a savings if you're buying less overall, even if your per unit price goes up in some cases. So I think it's something to look into, especially since the online access is so expensive, and we're putting a lot of resources into that, and more people are using that. It seems like we should move away from the paper versions.
One of the things, obviously not for today, but I think one of the things Representative Fortman would like is like some items on the cost on the cost of the statutes, and maybe an experimental opt-in system would be interesting. For example, one of the things that we talked about is just having one set of statutes in a central place in each corner of the state office building, for example.
Madam Chair, Ms. Timmons, if I could also just see a copy of what the opt-out letter looks like, and some information about when that goes out and who it goes to. That would be very helpful.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Winkler. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Timmons, this is sort of a, I guess, a lawyer question, but why do we print a new set every year of those statute books rather than just doing a pocket part addition to the back and then reprinting every 5 years or 3 years or something like that?
Yeah. Ms. Timmons? Yeah. Madam Chair, members, Representative Winkler, we print the set every 2 years. And then we do a pocket part every other year. So we do that.
Okay. We're going to have to move a little bit faster, because we do have a visitor. We do have a visitor for the last half hour. So we'd like to get through the session. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Great.
Just to say thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Okay.
Chair, I'm trying to jump out of order. I have
obviously
two bills and another committee shortly.
Okay.
I'm here to talk about the Great Lakes Commission. I think you have received a handout. And the Great Lakes Commission is an organization federally chartered, represents the 8 Great Lakes states, and has adjunct memberships from the 2 Canadian provinces, Ontario and Quebec, that border also the Great Lakes. The role of the commission is both conservation and as well as economic development. Obviously, sometimes those two are in conflict, but the commission's job is to try to coordinate the activities of the 8 states and 2 provinces in terms of both conservation and economic development activities, to serve as a information resource place, and then as an advocacy place. We lobby in Washington on issues that the eight states can agree on. Currently, the biggest issue is invasive species, and we're trying to get a national approach to that rather than having each state try to do something on their own. I think this year, finally, with Congressman Oberstar having a huge interest in this, there's going to be some national solution. If you look at the history of the dues, currently are $60,000. In general, the commission sends more than that back to the state of Minnesota in terms of grants to various places like soil and water conservation districts, some money to the DNR, so that it is a net benefit to the state to be a member. In terms of the budget, the dues were raised 4 years ago to $60,000 from $40,000, and that was, of course, just at the time of the state's financial crisis. So we are basically 4 years behind in our dues. We've been paying $40,000 a year instead of $60,000, and the net of that is we're about $70,538 behind in our dues. We do have a legal obligation sometime to pay that, but I will say as the media just served the past 2 years as the chair of the national organization, it's a little embarrassing to have to explain every year when we do our budget why Minnesota is behind. But to be honest, not a lot, but there's usually two or three states that are behind a year doing their dues because they all have the same financial problems. Okay. And eventually they get caught up. So the proposed budget has a one-time payment of the $70,000 plus to take care of our arrears, and then jumps up the dues payment in our budget to what the dues are of $60,000. And I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and I will try to help you move along so you'll have plenty of time for the others. The numbers in our budget requests are those that follow the guidelines of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, plus our request, which we discussed the other day, to be able to maintain the fees that are paid by four organizations that we audit. Be happy to answer any questions about the numbers, but I would like to just give you very briefly a picture of how we're doing at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Having gone through the budget cuts, and I think they affected us maybe a little bit more than some of the other organizations, we went from 79 professional staff to 62. And I'm quite proud of our ability to absorb that cut and remain a strong and effective audit and oversight organization. We took those cuts and reduced our staff, starting with eliminating one of our deputy legislative audit positions, and I also eliminated my confidential secretary position, and we went on down through the organization, cutting positions and tightening our organization. And being the auditor, I think that's what is expected of us. But the goal was always that we remain strong and effective. And with your help, I think we've done that. After we got past the budget cuts, however, our new challenge was simply keeping people. As you've heard from many organizations, it is a very competitive market for the kinds of people that we hire. And we've experienced the same challenge that other organizations have. The best way to illustrate that is to tell you that within our financial audit division, where we have our CPAs and other people with certification, for example, to audit computer systems, half of the people who we started with at the beginning of this biennium are no longer with us. Our turnover has been staggering. And it's not just a loss of people. It's a loss of talent and experience. So we're in the mode of rebuilding, and I think we're going to be successful. We are able to attract people. We are able to give them a good professional experience. We're working to try to recognize and reward them as best we can, and most importantly, to let them know that their work is important and appreciated. So we're hopeful that we will rebuild. Our budget request would like to stabilize our staff at the current 62 number. So, Madam Chair and members, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Ms. Snow? Good. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Robbie LaFleur. I'm the director of the Legislative Reference Library, and I'll also be very brief. I could talk at great length and with much enthusiasm about the library and its services, but this presentation will be short and highlight just the most essential needs of the library. I could give you much detail about anything. We build our budget from zero, and I document everything that's needed. Last Wednesday, the members of the library subcommittee heard a bit longer briefing, and they were very supportive and approved the budget as requested. I think Representative Mary Murphy's comment was, go forth. The handout that I gave out has two sides. The boxes that are on the budget sheet with the little pictures include the points I feel are most important, have changes. There are details on the back of the sheet. You'll find the number of staff members in the library. We've had many staff decreases, too. We've gone from 18 to 13.5 since 2003. On that sheet, our needed computer equipment is listed. And most importantly, there's a list of some of our project goals for the biennium. Again, I'd love to talk about any of them. Our top priority is hiring a programmer who will also help with network administration and security-related needs in the library. Even though we don't like it, security tasks require more time and attention than just a few years ago and can't be ignored. We've been without our programmer position for 3.5 years since a layoff in 2003. We have a backlog of programming tasks at this point. And in general, we need to upgrade and consolidate many of the individual services we provide and improve the delivery technology. We've already made great progress. We've added electronic delivery to all of our services, and we've reduced the staff we need for things like photocopying and mailing. We need this position to integrate pieces of the library services and improve access to them through the web and to help with the development of the libraries and the legislature's websites. Just as an example of our programming needs, you may all know that the library is a depository for state documents, and in particular, all the reports that are required by the legislature. We track these with a really complex internal database. We read the session laws. We note all the reports that are required, send out letters, get the reports cataloged, and we archive them electronically. With our database, we can tell you in a blink all of the reports that have been submitted by agencies over the years, which ones are still due, and even for that matter, which ones are overdue. With an upgrade to make this database web accessible, you and anybody else will be able to do this, and very quickly. And just a couple words about our computer needs. Core technology needs, our core technology upgrades are now crucial. Technology has not stood still in the last 5 years, and our budget decreased. We abandoned our technology upgrade plan and deferred most of our technology purchases in order to avoid more staff cuts. And so our equipment budget line includes server replacements, and a list of that specific equipment is on the back of the sheet. And then one little point about the little boxes on the spreadsheet. One shows that this is a fairly modest bottom line. Even though our 2008 request is higher than our 2007 request, it's still $38,000 less than we had in 2002. And finally, there's a one-time request in the FY08 line to replace 8 easy chairs, the ones that are near the front of the library. We have not done any furniture upgrades since the library moved over from the Capitol 23 years ago. This money would also be for outlets on the top of the tables that are mostly used for laptops for students and staff and citizens, but also for the tape recorders, because people are still listening to cassette tapes of older committee hearings every day, the ones that aren't online. I'd be glad to answer any questions, now or any time.
Any questions for the library? Apparently not. Thank you very much. Oh, I have a question about the easy chairs. Where do you get them from?
Madam Chair and members, we so far have gone through one of the vendors, the estate vendor that we usually use, and gotten bids, and wow, I mean, better than I had anticipated.
Okay.
Representative Mary Murphy suggested checking out MinCor. I don't know if they do chairs, but we were going to check that out. So,
is MinCor the one that works through the prisons?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, they do. I have two. I have a set of furniture in my office inherited from Wayne Simino that came from the prison industries. So, okay. Okay. Next is Larry Martin, whom we've heard pretty much.
Yes.
Today.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm Larry Martin from the Legislative Commission on Pensions. I gave you essentially my presentation about a week ago, or was it earlier this week? So I would be happy to answer questions. Essentially, the Pension Commission's budget is the same level of effort. The only significant item or additional item is a small amount of money, $10,000 per year for actuarial work, should the Pension Commission need to have some actuarial calculations. That's the extent of our actuarial budget in recent years, and this would replace that amount in the budget. Other than that, members, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions, Mr. Morrison? Okay, thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, Greg Gibbinger again with the LCC. I'll be referring to the 15-page budget packet again. Page 8 is the operating budget for the LCC. The LCC provides the administrative support and processes payroll and accounts payable for the other joint agencies, and provides staffing for the Region's Candidate Advisory Council and its cousin for MinSCU, provides staffing for the Compensation Council and the Electric Energy Task Force and the Claims Committee, to name a few. We also do personnel items on behalf of the full legislature, such as the legislative plan for employee benefits, which applies to the full legislature. We're proposing a budget of $766,000 each year, which is the same level effort. Madam Chair, the next page refers to the pass-through budgets for the LCC. It's labeled LCC Other. These are items where the LCC acts as the fiscal agent for the full legislature, and it's the portion of the budget where we pay for the sign language interpreters, for interpreters who interpret for legislative hearings and meetings with members. Those costs have roughly doubled in the last 2 years, and we're proposing budgets that reflect that increased demand. This is where the legislature pays for its dues for NCSL and CSG, for the costs for the 24 citizen members for the Region's Candidate Advisory Council and the MinSCU Board of Trustee Council. This is also where we are proposing to pay for the costs that Department of Finance charges the legislature for indirect costs for the House and the Senate and the LCC for its use of Semaphore and MAFS. We've been ignoring the invoices for the last 2 years, and we committed to at least presenting this portion in our budget, either to have the legislature appropriate the money to pay for it, or else to seek a waiver so that the LCC would be exempt from those fees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hubinger, with respect to the NCSL and the CSG, what kind of things do we get for that? I mean, the dues look rather significant to me.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative De La Forest. I'm more familiar with the services that we receive from NCSL in terms of technical support, policy support, briefings. They've done training for members. There were some fees involved, but they, as I mentioned earlier, conducted the compensation study for the House and the Senate and the LCC.
Okay.
Madam Chair, then I'll move on to the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations. This is a five-member. This is on page 10 of the handout. This is
Madam
a five, yes. five House member.
I'm sorry. I have a question on your last thing. You said something about you've been ignoring some invoices for a couple of years, and you said you would at least present it. And I thought you said the word semaphores, but can you go over that part again?
Madam Chair and Representative Hortman, the legislature, the House and the Senate and the LCC all use different components of the state's accounting system to manage their part of the appropriations and their expenditures. And Department of Finance recoups some of the costs that they incur in managing those systems by charging fees to state agencies and to the legislature.
And we're just not paying ours?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
The next page refers to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. This is a 10-member, 5-House member, 5-Senate member group that reviews and provides interim approval of the state labor contracts. It meets mostly during the interim. This budget reflects the cost for parts of 2 staff that support it and the members per diem. We're requesting the same level effort for that committee.
Okay.
I'll skip over the Great Lakes Commission, and then we're up to the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and Representative Johnson, the chair, is here.
Okay. Before you go, we've had a lot of discussion in bills, and I don't know how this is going to quite be handled, of people are sort of start to do these independent commissions and then decide that the perfect place for them is the LCC. We have about 3 of these that are, 2 at least, I think I know, that are floating around. And you know who gets to make a decision on that, and do we just increase your budget and let you wing it, or what happens?
Well, Madam Chair, our office also prepares fiscal notes on bills that affect financially the legislature, and we play this guessing game about with the marginal cost about what it costs to support a new commission. And if it's just one, we could handle it with existing staff, but if it's 3 or 4 or 5, it can get to be a challenge.
I haven't heard that many, but I think I've heard 2. Well, what happens if people come in with 2 and we make them into 1? Does that become 1? Okay. All right. Okay, thank you. Certainly, the easy answer is they're not included in this budget.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief since we were also here last week or so. I'm here as the chair of the Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and just a brief refresher. We're a 15-member commission, and our goal is to promote, enhance, preserve the resources of the Mississippi River Valley, and we are the byway organization of the Great River Road. There's 3 change items I'd like to refer to briefly as you look at the spreadsheet you may have before you. One is per diem costs. The change reflects an addition of 5 citizen members representing geographical segments along the Mississippi River, and these were added by statute in 2002, which was following year was a time of the big budget cutbacks as well. The second one entails professional and technical services. The change to $19,500, that reflects the ending of a 5-year federal seed grant that we're operating under that help pay for administrative costs. And I'll remind chair and members that we have no full-time staff that works with the commission. And lastly, I'll note, as we heard from Representative Huntley and the Great Lakes Commission, the Mississippi River Parkway Commission also pays dues, $15,000 a year in dues, to the National Great River Parkway Commission. And that helps coordinate with the other 10 river states in our common mission of the Great River Road. And we've fallen behind in those dues, and that increase will help provide the necessary catch-up. I will also would like to note that we're an organization that brings in money to the state. Since the year 2000, we brought in around $900,000 in federal highway grants. Since it was at that time, the Great River Road was designated as a national scenic byway, which made us eligible for grants, which we have applied to and have successfully achieved and implemented. And that's our presentation, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Next is Sperry LeGrave.
Good Madam Chair and members, I'm Barry LeGrave. I'm the director of the House Public Information Services Office. Steve Senek, the director of Senate Media Services, was not able to be here today. I'm testifying on behalf of page 13 of the LCC pamphlet, which is the legislative television money. These are the funds that the House and Senate use to distribute legislative television programming to the citizens of Minnesota. Our base funding has been $360,000 per year for the last 4 to 6 years. We're seeking an increase to $600,000 per year. These are the funds that we use for three things. We establish a broadcast television contract with Twin Cities Public Television Channel 17. We have a satellite delivery to select greater Minnesota cable stations. And then we also hire court reporters to do live closed captioning of legislative television coverage. The increase that we're seeking to the higher amount is as a result of a proposal that the Minnesota Public Television Association has provided to the House and the Senate. The proposal is that the Minnesota Public Television Association would distribute legislative television programming to their six stations across the state, resulting in 97% to 98% of the citizens receiving legislative television coverage. The six stations of the Minnesota Public Television Association are Duluth, Brainerd, Fargo-Moorhead, Appleton, Austin, and of course Twin Cities Public Television. So those are the funds and the reason for the increase. We think this is a terrific opportunity to reach the vast majority of citizens in the state with the television coverage that's produced by the House and the Senate. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the last item that is in your budget is on page 14 of the packet, and it relates to the Healthcare Access Commission. This commission has met somewhat infrequently in the last couple of years, but when it does not use all of its appropriations, the balances are divided and the funds sent to defray staff costs in House research and Senate counsel and research. I understand that there is intention for this commission to be more active in the next biennium, and this is the same level budget.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, that completes our presentation.
Okay. And we just have Paul Schweitzer, the controller for the House, and then we can get to our special guest. So, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Schweitzer, House controller. I have presented for the committee. You should have a two-page handout which shows the House budget that was approved by the House Rules Committee for presentation to this committee. Budget is for a request for appropriation of approximately $61 million, $61.3 million, I believe is what's stated. This amount represents an increase over the past. Historically, though, compared to fiscal year 03, 6 years ago, this is the fiscal year 09 request appropriation is only about 4.7% higher than fiscal year 03. 6 years of fairly low levels of appropriations. Over the past 2 years, we've had to do our best and make do with our appropriations, much like other agencies, but we did have the benefit of carry forward balances. As shown on your budget sheet, we have used those carry forward balances over the past 2 years in 06 and 07 to help us through this time. Our total spending for FY06 was approximately $25.9 million, but our appropriation was only $24,177,000. So our net carry forward spending in FY06 was about $1.7 million. For fiscal year 07, my estimate that's for the year ending this June is that we'll spend another $1 million or so out of our carry forward balance, leaving perhaps the carry forward balance at the end of the year of somewhere around $800,000, which is a significant decrease spending down of our assets from about over $5 million a few years ago. The requested budget includes a 2% cost of living increase for staff for each year. That was the amount that was recommended by the, as you know, the supplemental budget request. The governor did allocate an additional amounts, and that is shown on the spreadsheet in 08 and 09 as $417,000 in 08, $842,000 in 09. The House budget also reflects some other inflationary cost increases, such as the higher mileage rate, but it also reflects some cost savings that we've worked hard to achieve over the past several years. One is, as you know, we have a voice over IP telephone system. We made some significant investments to implement that. At the same time, those investments also upgraded our house computer network with switches and hubs and additional power supply, and also redundant routers. But with that, we still achieve operating cost savings of perhaps $150,000 compared to what we would be paying otherwise if we hadn't done that, based on the Office of Enterprise Technology's telephone rate increases that they have increased. So,
it's actually significant. That's something that was not done in the Senate. And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, and yes, that's correct. My understanding is they have not yet implemented a voice over IP telephone system. House technology, the proposed budget does reflect a significant increase in house technology. That's most evident in the equipment line, although that equipment line also includes other costs besides technology costs. It also includes potential furniture costs. It reflects potential change out to our TV equipment. As Barry LeGrave would tell you, a lot of the equipment we purchased is 6 to 8 years old. Many of it needs replacements for things like the robotics for rooms like that. It does not include the potential of bringing a TV to this room, to the basement hearing room. That would be that's perhaps farther out, but that would be. It was not on his list, but it would be a desirable thing at some point in the future, but it is not included in this budget at this point. The proposed budget.
When is the upgrade to new laptops for the House coming in?
Madam Chair, members, we have increased the estimate for FY07. The plan is to purchase, to replace those laptops yet this fiscal year, so that members will have, so we'll be able to distribute them before members leave for the year. The model to be selected has not been selected yet, but some staff members are looking at that, have some laptops that they're trying out.
Okay.
This budget also reflects a 3.5% merit increase for House staff in each year. Over the past 2 years, in fiscal year 07, fiscal year 06, House staff did receive a 3.5% merit increases, so this continues that trend. However, staff did not receive an increase of any kind in fiscal year 05, and fiscal year 04, there was no increase to the base level. So the current budget, and there was no cost of living adjustment really since fiscal year 03. So this budget, to be clear, includes a 2% cost of living adjustment each year, as well as a 3.5% merit increase each year. With our full-time equivalent complement, we're maintaining at approximately, with very little growth over the past several years, we're at about 253. We were at around 251 a couple of years ago. We've added very little. Over the past few years, as you know, we did add a fiscal analyst position reinstated that position this year. But overall, we're down about 28 positions from back from a high when we had around 280 positions back several years ago. Those positions are not reflected in the current budget. Those are considered eliminated positions. And the budget does reflect the increased cost for member expense reimbursements approved by the Rules Committee earlier in January. Those costs also are reflected in the House budget. Madam Chair, those are the highlights, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you or the members of the committee will have.
Any questions from Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schweitzer, can you tell me what the leases and rentals are on the budget sheet that you gave to us?
Yes, Representative Anderson and Representative Kahn, the House does enter into various leases. For fiscal year 08 and 09, I'm estimating that we will have expenses for things like room rentals, things like rental of buses, and things like rental of pagers and miscellaneous equipment. I expect that the House committees will tend to be more active. We'll tend to go out to outstate Minnesota for more hearings, and I'm anticipating some additional expenses for things like bus rental and room rentals.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay.
Paul, thank you for coming, Madam Chairman. You mentioned 253 approximate employees we have right now. Besides the House staff itself, who does that all include? House staff being about 150 of that, I think.
Mr.
House, I should say the House majority minority staff.
Okay. Yes, thank you for that clarification. Representative Kahn and Representative Swigum, I'm sorry, I don't have a list right in front of me of full-time by staffing. I may try to find it as I dig through my papers, but it would reflect the two caucuses, as you said, for House DFL and Republican caucuses, and the cost of the staff in the chief clerk's office, in the budget accounting, human resources, public information services, the post office facility services, House Research Department, so all the other non, and I'm afraid I may have forgotten an important department, but I apologize. But those are all the nonpartisan departments as well would all be included.
Madam Chair, Paul, would it be fair to say that the reduction you talked about from 5 and 6 years ago, most of that reduction took place in the House staff itself, the House minority majority staff?
Representative Kahn, Representative Swigum, and members, we worked very hard during that time period of budget cuts to try to spread the cuts across the across all departments, for caucuses and the nonpartisan departments as well. It was a difficult time. Like all other state agencies, we had to do some reductions. We tried to do it through across the board, working with department directors to establish a plan to do that in a respectful way, ways that would minimize layoffs, I'm sure, like other agencies did, but in ways to take advantage of open positions in many cases by not filling those vacancies and trying to. Try to manage our budget reductions that way, and I know with your help and support, I think that was well received by the considering the budget circumstances that we were under.
And Madam Chair, just one last question. Then, in your cover letter to us, Paul, by the way, thank you for the management. You do a wonderful management of our House budget. You really are a very good manager from the financial standpoint. There, I look to my colleague here, Mr. DeForest, and and look at your tactfulness in your letter, where you talk on the front page about the increased pressures due to salary increases for house staff, temporary staffing, equipment, technology, and then you say, and other expense reimbursement increases for members. That would include specifically what again?
I think we know.
I just want it on the tape.
Okay.
It may be an issue here in a week or so.
Madam Chair, Representative Swigum, yes, the increases were the per diem increases from $66 to $77 approved by Rules Committee in January, and the change in the lodging for members. While the dollar amount remained at $1,200 a month, members are now eligible for year-round lodging, and that will be for all members. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I thought that's what the other meant, but you tactfully said other rather than specific.
Okay. I've always found that Mr. Schweitzer is very amenable to any further detailed discussions, and I don't really want to cut him off, but I do want to get to the next, since we did have a scheduled out-of-town person, but we'll take... I do want to get to that person, but let's move quickly.
Madam Chair, just briefly... Mr. Schweitzer, does this include committee budgets in here?
Yes, Madam Chair, Anderson. Yes, it does. The committee budgets have not been approved yet, but the committee budgets run on a two-year on a two-year basis. That's not the same as a fiscal year. What I've done is align items, though. Again, yes, I'm anticipating expenses for committees and things like always, and things like members per diem for interim per diem. And other travel registration expenses. So yes, they are included.
Okay, just broken out by there. Each little category then.
Yes, but by these line items, I don't have a specific accounting for those because the way we do the budgeting, basically do the budgeting on line item based on estimates going forward and the way we spent money in the past. So by line item as opposed to by committees.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Swigum, and to my other Metro colleagues across the aisle and next to me. The year-round housing was for folks outside of, he said, for all members, and as long as we were being technical on the record, there are some of us who do not take any housing for year-round and travel within the 50 miles or whatever it is, but it's not all members that receive year-round housing.
Mr. Chair,
okay.
Yes, 57 members are currently eligible for lodging.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry to rush a little bit, but I did want to leave some time for the presentation on government reform from Steve Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And remember, all members, just don't hesitate to go see Paul and find out any detail you want. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dahl, came pretty close to getting you the time we promised you, but...
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Steve Dahl. I'm director from Deloitte Consulting LLP here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I lead our consulting services that we provide to the state of Minnesota, as well as our public sector consulting practice in the Midwest region of the U.S., and also led our services on the Drive to Excellence project for the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about government reform, including focusing on some options, how to pay for it, and how to measure results, and some lessons learned as we go through. And you should have a copy of a presentation in front of you, and I'll be walking through that. So please stop me and ask questions as we go along, and I'm not going to go through all the detail of the words on here, but try to really hit the key points for you. And the source for a lot of the information that's in the presentation really comes out of a new book that we just released at Deloitte called States of Transition, which I put a copy of that in your packets for each of you, and then earmarked with the flyer there the chapter that I co-authored on transforming state government. So just some further takeaway background information, reading material for you that hopefully you find helpful. I look forward to our discussion dialogue here today, and hope to provide some information that's insightful and helpful in your process.
I just also noticed that the flyer is on the electronic licensing system, which is one of the things we're looking at.
Oh, great.
Starting in some way.
Okay. Great. If you go to on page one, just really to start with a little background on transformation and our point of view on it, my point of view on it, it's in short looking at, we can all do more with more and we can do less with less, but really to do more with less takes fundamentally looking at business, looking at how work is done, process and technology, how that's all done from a different perspective, doing the work differently, reforming things from an enterprise point of view. So looking at across the enterprise, across the entire state, better linkages between programs and business processes, more uniform methodologies, frameworks, use of technology and standards, organizing services from the perspective of citizens and businesses instead of agencies, and developing shared services models wherever practical and possible to share the resources and the infrastructure of the state. If you look at on slide two, some questions that we really focus on and ask when we're looking at reform initiatives for people are really some basic things. Are you ready? Are your people ready? And I think here in Minnesota, a lot of time and effort has been focused on assessment and strategy and building business cases, developing a state team and structure, and clearly the desire and the team is there to drive reform, which is a very positive, good thing. Looking at what is your issue, so what are the problems you're trying to solve or opportunities you're trying to harvest in Minnesota, that's certainly preparing for the future, better access to service, savings, improving quality, among other things, but key drivers for why you want to do reform. And then next, can you engage key stakeholders? So understanding really who cares about this and why do they care and what's important to them. And you've done a lot of that as well. But the bottom line really gets to then at some point, can you get the resources? Do you have the people? Do you have the money dedicated to execute on the plans and the reforms in front of you? And the options for getting those resources or financing are certainly multiple. And a couple of the first ones here that I've listed out are ones that we're all fairly familiar with and I know you've been working quite a bit with, and that's certainly traditional funding through appropriations, outsourcing or managing services, or leasing arrangements. What I'd really like to focus some discussion around here today is the last three, which are coming trends in the public sector. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But also more innovative ways to make some of this happen when general fund dollars are in short supply. Those include bonding, investment funds, value-based or performance-based contracts. If you go to the next page, and number three, first to talk a little bit about bonding. The National Association of State CIOs did a study released back in November of 2003 on innovative funding for innovative state IT, which a lot of information that I've captured here comes from that. And in that, even back in 2003, they got survey responses from 23 states, and nearly half of those states were using bonding to pay for major technology improvements. And it really takes, from a more traditional point of view, it takes thinking about technology in a little bit different mindset than what a lot of folks are used to thinking about. It's really core infrastructure for the state for running a business. It's like adding a building. Matter of fact, by adding technology services online, you may avoid building a building. So there's a lot of commonality, and that's a lot of the thought process that people have when they look at this. So, and that can be general obligation or revenue bonds. And if you go to the next page on page four, a couple of examples. Massachusetts did three major bond initiatives to fund their major transformations. They've certainly been out front on a lot, doing a lot of pretty innovative things. from 1992 to 2002, they did three bondings, one for a little over $90 million and two for right around $300 million. So over $700 million was raised for major technology improvements. So that's one option that states have on the table. And again, a number of states are doing this as they look to how do we pay for these types of things.
Now, Mr. Dahl, this is a question I've asked several times. And our bond council continually tells us that we can't. Do we need a new bond council? Or what's, do they have different restrictions in their constitution? I keep saying I can't believe that our state constitution said we couldn't bond for computers. But
I could tell you the specifics about Minnesota's constitution, but clearly a number of states have that allowed within their constitution. And in Minnesota, if that's not allowed, it would certainly then require some change or amendment.
Well,
yeah. But it is a common trend right now when people looking at this. And when these are big dollar amounts for major improvements, so it's a very common approach, because you've heard many times these technologies that drive the business being around 10, 20, or even more years. So a long life cycle. On page 5, talk a little bit about internal investment funds. And this is really a concept where monies are pooled together to pay for more typically pilot programs, new technologies, or projects with shorter payback periods. But it's really a pool of money that's put to use in a loan format, where agencies really apply for these loans. They get the money, and then the money is paid back through future savings or revenue enhancements over time. I'd really like to focus on and point to the second bullet point here, which talks about the state legislature providing initial seed money to establish these investment funds. And I think that's a really important point, because a lot of people have tried to do these funds where it's just through internal billings. And the challenge that we've seen folks run into is what I'll call the timing challenge. So in other words, if you're doing a major project or initiative in year one, the savings often come in year two and year three. And so you're cutting across budget periods. And so if there isn't that pool of seed money sitting there to utilize across that budget time period, it makes it really difficult to make these internal investment funds or revolver funds effective. Going to the next page, I'll just point down at the bottom a couple of examples of how some states have and government organizations have gotten the seed money. Philadelphia Productivity Bank, which has been around for quite some number of years to fund government reform, got their initial $20 million in seed money from a bond issuance. South Carolina, which has a similar type productivity or loan program, actually got their seed money by allowing carryover budget dollars into a savings account for agencies for technology projects. A third example I'll just touch on briefly is Tennessee has a systems development fund, and they started that up with $10 million in one-time appropriation money from the legislature. So it was a pretty innovative use of one-time money. The next slide on page 7 talks a little bit about value-based billing. I've got a lot of detail on here in the next few slides, but I'll talk just basically about the concept. And value-based billing really looks at offloading a lot of the upfront cash needed and a lot of the risk to a vendor. So if you want to do a major project, you don't have the money for it, but you see the value and the return on this. So you don't want to wait, and it doesn't make sense from a financial standpoint to wait. This is a common mechanism to get this done. So you go out and really state the problem, what needs to happen to the vendor community. They come back with proposed solutions. It is needs to be a very collaborative process to work through that. And they propose a solution, actually implement a new technology, or it can be a process reengineering project, a strategic sourcing, any kind of reform project. They implement that basically on their own dollar. And the way they get paid back at the end of the day is based on the results of the project. So there has to be some kind of new revenue stream or savings stream that's very tangible and measurable that we can then go back and pay these vendors for their efforts. So so that's kind of how value-based billing works. Where it's at risk is if the project doesn't go the way it's supposed to go or the way everyone plans, the vendor's not going to get paid. We're not get paid all the money that, that they plan to. But at the same point, these typically then have a fair amount of an upside because they're taking this risk. So if the the project goes extraordinarily well, better than anticipated, they'll get paid a surplus amount or an extra amount for the risk they've taken on. That's how basically how value-based billing projects work. Right now, more than a third of the states, are using some form of value-based billing for their technology and other transformation initiatives. If you go to slide 10, I'll talk for a few minutes about performance-based contracts. And performance-based contracts are similar in a lot of ways to value-based, but probably the biggest difference is the amount that, that vendors put at risk and the amount of risk sharing that, that occurs in those. But basically, the way performance-based contracts work is that a state will identify a project and a number of key measures. Here's how we measure success in this initiative. Maybe it's half a dozen key measures. And the vendor will come forth with their pricing. And if those measures of success are met, they'll get paid the price that they were committed to. If they're not, they'll get paid some lesser amount. So they might get paid $1,000 if that was the number, if everything's met. If they aren't, maybe it's $500 what they get paid. But then at the same point, if the project is a huge success and it exceeds that, they'll get a performance-based incentive and may get paid $1,500. These some variation of performance-based contracts are used by virtually every state at this point in time.
Thank you. Yeah. I just have a couple questions about the e-licensing sheet from the book.
What
I'm wondering is if the Office of Enterprise Technology put out a request for proposals, and if a number of different firms submitted proposals, and if you know if any of your competitors submitted proposals on the e-licensing?
You're talking about the RFP they let out this last fall?
I was asking if there was an RFP.
There had been one, and a number of firms bid on it, including ourselves, and then that was that procurement was canceled in January. Our understanding is that that's coming back around, but that's the history on it, yeah.
Madam Chair, then just a follow-up. So has Deloitte and Touche entered into a contract with the state of Minnesota to do the e-licensing program? Or
no.
Just one other question. Is your firm publicly traded?
No, we're not. We're a partnership, privately held.
And is the partnership owned by a Swiss company?
No, we're a U.S. Deloitte Consulting and LLP is a U.S. company, but we're part of a global network of firms, and that global network of firms is organized in an association that's and that association is a Swiss, what's called a Swiss baron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been hanging around Tommy Rukavina a fair amount of time.
I was going to say, if we go down this path, is Tommy Rukavina going to be mad at us?
All right. Other questions before I get into a little bit on the measuring results?
We'll go a little bit later, okay, too. So, yeah. Representative Winkler?
Actually, I think my questions can come after the benefit savings validation.
Okay. Great, thank you. If you go to slide 12, one of the challenges that exists with every one of these mechanisms is looking at how do you actually measure the results and how do you actually determine what is that new revenue stream, what is that cash savings stream that will go back to pay for this, whether it's to pay for bonds or pay for an internal revolver investment fund or pay a vendor through a value-based billing or performance contract. That's a bottom-line question with every one of those. So what we've laid out, and there's some on this in the book as well, is really a 10-step process around conducting benefits and savings validations. And where a little bit of history on this, we developed this with the state of Illinois, and a number of projects I've been working with them on over the last couple of years, because it really wasn't what we saw as a real good standardized method to do this within the industry. But it really boils down to a few things. First step on here is determining, making sure everyone understands what we're doing and why we're doing it. Second one is coming to a common understanding of what is the baseline. So in other words, if you're going to try to measure savings or try to measure new revenues, what's our starting point? And making that real clear, making sure everyone understands that, because if not, going backwards to try to find that can be very difficult, because you can have half a dozen people in a room and they each come back with a different starting point that they think is the right place to start from. So developing a baseline that's strong and clearly understood is very critical. A next step is determining what are the types of savings that count. Does cost avoidance count in your calculation? An example of that would be if you put services online and you avoided building a new building because of that, does the savings because you didn't build that building, does that count as a savings in what you're doing? How do you handle one-time savings versus recurring savings that go through a long period of time, et cetera? So getting to a firm understanding of what you think should count and making sure that everyone's on board with it. The fourth item is really then looking at that there needs to be transparency and accountability, and looking at the documents to support the savings. So going back to general ledgers, vendor payments, other things that are clearly identifiable and transparent. Fifth item is then defining categories that might be helpful and useful in analyzing savings. And if you go to the next page, it's really then about inventorying the transformation projects and doing the financial calculations, running the numbers based on everything that's been agreed upon. Ninth item on there is I'm capturing what did it cost to do it, what were the incremental payments that were made to vendors for consulting, hardware, software, et cetera, so you can come to a good understanding of what's your return on investment. And then the last item is making sure that you capture the other benefits. So there's certainly cash benefits, but there's other benefits that are the reason you do these projects, quality improvements, better access for constituents, et cetera. So making sure those are captured as well. And a key point on that, that's always a real struggle when you look at how to measure savings and getting to a number that everyone can agree on, is I'll give you an example of you go through a big transformation project, and a lot of the savings that'll often occur is you have somebody's job, a number of the responsibilities that have now been moved or changed because you've changed the process and changed the technology. So they've got a third of their hours in the day are now available. Instead of pushing paper around or doing something like that, they can maybe now be serving a customer. Well, they've saved time. It's a clear savings. And they're doing it, they're using that time to do something else that may be of higher value to the organization. But you're typically not going to cut that position because you've only cut out a third of their hours. So how do you account for those what I'll call softer savings versus the real hard cash savings? And it gets down to kind of what are the show me the money kind of things that you can actually track into a budget and use dollars to pay for pay back loans, et cetera. And what are the other items, and how important are those, and how to track and measure those?
Okay. Now who have you particularly been working with? With OET people, with the Drive to Excellence, or the Department of Administration?
On the savings?
Yeah, on any, on thinking about what's happening with Minnesota.
Well,
before the RFP process was canceled, obviously there were contacts and so forth. So,
sure.
But where what was the touch point for that?
Well, a variety. It's really from the Drive to Excellence, sub-cabinet, staff members, office enterprise technology, et cetera, as being key drivers in the reform in Minnesota. And Other questions on that?
Other questions?
I'll jump just, if I could, real quickly. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, Ryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm on the sheet here on the electronic licensing system. There is sort of narrative information about reduced operating costs.
Mm-hmm.
I would be accustomed to seeing some sort of return on investment timeline and, you know, soft ROI, hard ROI,
sure,
and of all that sort of stuff. And we get a lot of narrative, I would say,
right,
in the legislature about how we're going to save costs, it's going to be more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. But typically, a vendor in IT would have to show in pretty clear terms what those,
right,
estimates are going to be, so that we had something firm to go back and compare to later to make sure it happened. If not, mm-hmm, why not? If it was better, great, that kind of thing.
Right.
So is that something that Deloitte has been asked to develop, or is it something that is there, but you just, you know, how does that work in this process?
Well, that becomes part of the proposal process, really, and we're certainly prepared to respond to that when that process kicks off. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Normally, what you want to see is, you know, what is it going to cost? What are the estimated benefits? What's the timeline for that? What's the timeline for implementation? What's the related cost timelines? And what are the estimates of kind of the cash flow of when the savings will come in? And then ultimately, what's your return on investment? We've certainly gone through those items, and we're prepared to respond with those.
And, Madam Chair, testifier, you know, typically that would be divided, I guess, into sort of hard ROI, soft, mm-hmm, ROI, and a lot of the,
right,
measurement that you were talking about would kind of fall under the soft ROI. How does it, when you work with, say, OET or with the agencies, and you're talking about reforming business process, do you have some of the soft ROI numbers after you've gone through and done the requirements and sort of have an idea of what you're going to actually be implementing and how that might change a business process? Or do you have sort of a preliminary ROI that changes once you've gone through the requirements process?
Yeah, let me answer that question, if I could, by going to, if you go to slide 15, and I'll just point out these are some of the lessons learned on these types of initiatives and projects. I'm going to go to the very last bullet point, which is user business case. And the point I'd make there is what we found throughout really most all our reform efforts, it is really critical to have a business case at the start. So that business case defining the scope of what you're doing, why you're doing it, who's involved, what it's going to cost, what it's going to save you, what the timeline is, all the details you'd expect to see in that business case. But then it's really important, I think, that business case, it isn't stagnant. It evolves over time. So you have a preliminary case and set of numbers, and then, you know, as you go through and start executing on the transformation initiative or in the project, you go and you update that business case as you go through, because the numbers start out softer, and the further along you get, if you're staying focused on it and driving to it, those numbers get harder as you move through it, get more solid, because you're getting smarter and smarter as you get further into the process.
And, Madam Chair, another follow-up. Thank you for your humoring me. You also mentioned in the e-licensing improved customer service.
Mm-hmm.
Is what, you know, as you went through this process, would establishing some kind of satisfaction survey or, mm-hmm, measurements be part of what you're doing?
Yeah.
Because that would be the other side of, you know, knowing what your outcomes are, would be bringing hard evidence,
right,
of improved customer satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look in the book, there's a write-up or a case study in there, too, about the Compass system that we developed in Pennsylvania, and what that is really around integrated eligibility for people getting health and human services from the state. Same type of a concept, licenses, of, you know, where in today's environment where people would have to go to multiple agencies, fill out multiple applications, go through multiple interview processes, et cetera, to get the funding. In that particular case example, developing a system where there's kind of one entry point and making it easier to find what you need to do, how to do it, and get to the benefits or services in the case of licensing that the business or individual wants. So improving customer service, that's a huge benefit to these types of systems most often.
But Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize, and you know, as we look at these OAT projects and other things coming forward, one thing I'm always would be interested in is what the ROI is and what the plan is for ongoing improvements as well.
Right.
You know, the customer satisfaction improvement that you get when you first implement a system is one thing, but often they'll be the best source of how you could refine it further. And
yep.
So I hope that as we look at more specific projects, again, there will be highlighted, you know, sort of what the plan is for determining whether or not the customer service aspect is really improved and how you're going to monitor that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, and I think it's an important part of each business case when we look at it is what's the impact on the customer.
Further questions? Okay, we actually have the minutes before us. Representative Portman moves adoption of the minutes of March 20th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Well, thank you very much. This has been sorry that we kind of crammed you in, but I was very glad that we got the opportunity to start thinking about these before. I don't know how much of this detailed budget processing will be for all this we'll be doing in, but we're certainly going to be thinking about clever ways to move forward on a very large appropriation request that the governor has made to us without really giving us enough of the funding to fund it. So,
okay, thank you, and you know, anything I can do to be of help.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, meeting adjourned.